Welcome to Managing Uncertainty, a podcast series from the experts at BrightPath discussing global risk, business continuity, and crisis management. Will you be ready to lead your organization through its critical moment?
Hello and welcome back to the Managing Uncertainty podcast. This is Brian Strauser, Principal and CEO at BrightPath, and joining me for today's episode about Hong Kong and what's going on in the Special Administrative Region of Hong Kong is...
Hi, this is Jen Otremba, Senior Consultant at BrightPath.
Hi, this is Bray Wheeler, Consultant at BrightPath.
So this is our deep dive episode where we're going to get into a topic and talk about kind of its impact on business and some processes and things that you should be thinking about. And we're going to focus on the current situation in Hong Kong, where if you've been paying attention, there have been protests like they have not seen protests before going on in Hong Kong. These protests are targeted against a proposed bill, which has now been suspended but not withdrawn. This bill would have allowed the extradition of Hong Kong citizens to countries that Hong Kong does not have an extradition treaty with. That's a really fancy way of saying that China would be able to charge Hong Kong citizens with a crime under Chinese law and then have Hong Kong export Hong Kong citizens to mainland China for trial. Why is that a problem?
Well, I think the big thing for Hong Kong is the fact that they enjoy some pretty good autonomy mm-hmm. from China in terms of their control, and Hong Kong citizens are pretty passionate about that fact.
And I think they like their independence.
They like their independence. They like being different. And I think for them, it's a little bit of a easy backdoor for China to be able to get in there and grab protest leaders, political opponents, folks who speak ill of China. That's Hong Kong, citizens of Hong Kong, that's their fear, is that it's not just as simple as it's made out to be, that it really gives China a lot of opportunity to go in and nab people and bring them out.
So I think we should probably talk just a little bit about Hong Kong's unique status in the world of China. Hong Kong was a British colony, but under treaty signed many, many, many years ago, it was given up in 1997 to China. So the British flag was lowered, the last governor general left, and the Hong Kong became the special administrative region of China, along with Macau, which did this, I believe, 2 years later. Mm-hmm. It's a former Portuguese colony, now also its own zone in China. But as a part of the treaty, China promised to respect the Hong Kong basic law, the constitution and statutes that control Hong Kong. And they didn't really meddle too much in Hong Kong, except for an attempt, I think it was 2003 or 2004, where they tried to extend through statute their national security apparatus, and the Hong Kong citizens were like, no, and they voted it down. Or maybe it was withdrawn, I don't know the specifics. But this has really been their first direct attempt in quite a while to interfere with the internal operations of Hong Kong, despite the fact that Chinese have a military base right on the harbor, but they don't really do much other than fly flags and drive tanks around and stuff.
They don't do much yet.
Yet. So the law, as the law is proposed, and they head towards debate, these protests were quite significant. I mean, Bray, hundreds of thousands and millions of people, right?
That it was 2 million were some of the estimates?
I think the last protest, yeah, north of 2 million. Which, by the way, that's a quarter, 20 or 25% of the total population of Hong Kong. It's just
yeah, they were saying massive. It was the biggest percentage of protesters to a population that has ever occurred. That
I mean, it's nuts.
And so far, nonviolent for the most part, right?
Yes.
Certainly yeah, disruptive, but...
Some skirmishes, I believe. There was reports of like tear gas and some confrontation with Hong Kong police as kind of in the early stages of the protest. But I think the last few days or last kind of segments of the protest has been fairly peaceful, considering you have millions of people out on the streets.
So one interesting aspect of all this was the business community plays a pretty significant role in the governance of Hong Kong. Their legislature in Hong Kong has a really unique relationship with the business community in two ways. The business community controls about a third of the legislature directly just through the way that representation is gained in Hong Kong. But also, there's a couple large individuals and companies that control a significant portion of Hong Kong infrastructure, like water and sewer and things that have been privatized that are just very different than how we think of them in the U.S. So they kind of have this very strong influence on the government that isn't the way we think of business influence on government.
I think one here controls in the West. Grocery stores, like all the grocery stores in Hong Kong.
I believe that's so correct. Yeah.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. There's like a kind of a titan of industry for each segment of Hong Kong, so to speak. And so they have some influence.
So there's a pretty insightful article in the New York Times from June 24th. From June 20th. So about 4 days ago, that says that the Chinese government's headquartered in Hong Kong was the home of a meeting about 6 weeks ago where the Chinese government summoned the 200 most powerful business leaders and told them that if you have worries about this bill, keep them to yourself.
Which they would.
It would be in their best interest, I think.
So I think they were kind of, they're a little scared, right? I mean,
it's a threat.
It seems like a not veiled threat.
Well, and based on everything that China's been doing over the last few years at least of corruption hunting within China among their business community and their political leaders. Yeah, that's not such a subtle threat that say this is happening and keep quiet and you'll enjoy your position of power in Hong Kong.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The business community's concern began back in March as this bill was initially being discussed when the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said that it had serious concerns about the bill that would reduce the appeal of Hong Kong to international companies considering Hong Kong as a base for regional and international operations. And there, by May 17th is when this 200-person-ish meeting was held at the Chinese government headquarters in Hong Kong. And then two of the senior officials in the Chinese Communist Party, Han Xing and Wang Yang, spoke publicly in Hong Kong in support of the bill, which is considered highly unusual for that kind of direct influence on internal Hong Kong legislation.
But I think that's part of the Hong Kong protesters' big worry here, too, is not only is it this bill allows China to just come in and they think snatch folks right out of the country and extradite them. And then charge them. It's also the influence that China is overtly having mm-hmm. with this bill. And that's always been part of their worry is that direct, open advocacy by China in Hong Kong.
And we might use the term snatch, but really we're talking here. This would all be done through the veil of right. legitimacy through the courts, right? They would charge somebody. China has very broad police power inside of China in terms of what their criminal law code defines. I mean, like political corruption, for example, is a death penalty offense in China, whereas we don't even arrest people for that here in the U.S., I think. But what this would allow, what the bill would allow the Chinese government to do is indict through their process, charge somebody with a crime in mainland China, and then using the Hong Kong courts, force Hong Kong to extradite them to China for trial, because it would just be an extradition. So that's where the fear comes from. You know, if you're not going to follow our direction, we'll just charge you and bring you to China, where you might wind up with a bullet in the back of your head.
Yeah.
Or however they're executing people nowadays.
Which is certainly concerning for the citizens, but what about the expats that are mm-hmm. United States citizens working in Hong Kong?
Right. And they're obviously subject to Hong Kong law. That's
right,
the way
of course.
It works.
Yep.
But could China charge them and extradite them because they were in Hong Kong?
I think according to this new law, they could, right?
Right. So the business impact, so it looks like the first major protest was on June 9th. There were hundreds of thousands of people that filled the streets in Hong Kong. And that's when the business impact started coming. The next day, June 10th, and again, I'm referring to the New York Times article from June 20th, a pro-Beijing lawmaker, Abraham Sheck, who also is a director of a company called Golden Financial, they're a major real estate developer in Hong Kong, they convened a board meeting. And Golden Financial was on the verge of completing and closing a property deal worth $1.4 billion where they were going to buy and develop a portion of the old airport in Hong Kong, which has been replaced by the new airport. And their board walked away from the deal. They broke the deal. They gave up a $3.2 million penalty. And their public statement was, the social contradiction and economic instability in Hong Kong makes it impossible for us to move forward with this real estate deal.
That's the real-time implications of not only this deal, but the pressure that they're starting to see in the manifestation of Hong Kong citizens kind of opposing this.
That's a pretty significant financial impact for the community.
So that was kind of the first brick that came out of the wall on the in the business community. The bigger move happened a few days later when they had protesters that surrounded the Legislative Council building. So that's the legislature for Hong Kong. And the protesters kept lawmakers from debating the bill. Because of their presence, there was tear gas and rubber bullets fired by law enforcement, which that's rare in Hong Kong. And this is right in the business district. So the business folks were watching this happen through their skyscraper windows down below. And that's when the squirming started in the business world. There was another billion-dollar property deal that was canceled, or I guess I should say postponed. The company refused to comment on that. And there seemed to be money movement out of Hong Kong by panicked investors, which that's never, Hong Kong being the finance center it is, that's never what they want to see happen there. And then on June 15th is when the bill was postponed by the chief executive, Carrie Lam.
Well, for the business community too, you know, that delay in investment, you know, they're facing some competition in Asia Pacific, especially from Singapore, I think the article referenced that too, but Singapore is becoming a pretty significant hub for global business and global investing.
Correct.
And to watch that stuff walk out of Hong Kong and into Singapore, that's super concerning for the business community.
Right. I mean, if it becomes both easier legally and financially better for corporations, that's...
There was also some noise around the, I mean, there's a lot of noise about this in the United States, but one interesting move that the Democrats in the United States House considered, Speaker Pelosi commented that perhaps it's time to revisit our statutory relationship with Hong Kong, because if China is going to exert influence like this, perhaps we should treat Hong Kong not as a separate legal entity, international entity, but we should treat it as part of China, if that's the way that they're going to approach. And what that really means, just if you take the context of the trade war, we have tariffs currently on Chinese manufactured goods that are shipped out of China. That tariff is 25%, so it's pretty significant. There's no tariff on Hong Kong goods coming in. If we were to treat Hong Kong like China, then we would require tariffs on Hong Kong shipments the way that we do on China shipments. And that would have a pretty significant impact on the Hong Kong economy and our relationship with businesses. And let's face it, most American companies, when they enter Asia, they start with Hong Kong. That's their base of operations. That's what we did at our previous employer.
Yeah.
Right? We ran stuff out of Hong Kong for all of Asia, even though most where our bodies were and where the work was being done was in mainland China. So I think for businesses, this, you know, depending upon the directions that this goes, and like most things China does, it will probably take decades for them to get to where they're going. But when they get to where they're going, it's not going to look like what it does today.
Yeah, I'm not going to be surprised if we start seeing businesses finding a new home for their expats. Maybe Singapore is the answer. Certainly not for the headquarters like a lot of companies have.
Right. Singapore's not that far away by air.
No.
It's just not as convenient as Hong Kong.
Right.
It's not as close to China where stuff was getting
produced.
And I think just from a global standpoint, you know, even if the U.S. was to walk away or reconsider how they view them, that's other countries are going to do the same, especially those that, you know, are close kind of partners, you know, United Kingdom, Australia, those other partners, because it's been that kind of easy entry point, that easy British entry point into Asia, we reevaluate and we find a different one. Or stuff gets shifted.
For a lot of companies, particularly U.S. companies, their large presence, manufacturing or sourcing, inspection for like soft lines goods and stuff, is really managed out of Shenzhen. because it's a special economic zone. There's some tax benefits to that. There's a large and available labor supply that's skilled and talented and speaks English in a lot of cases. The expats, though, all live in Hong Kong, and they commute to Shenzhen, which is a 30 to 45 minute drive, depending upon where in Shenzhen that you're going from Hong Kong. If you go there and sit at the border crossing and watch, there's a ton of people going north in the morning and a ton of people coming back south at the end of the day. So, yeah, I think this as you say about expats, I think this would have an impact over time on what that starts to look like.
Right.
So what should companies do now that we've talked a little bit about the context of what's happened?
Yeah, the proactive right now, right? Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier before we started the podcast on business continuity plans, right, Bray?
Mm-hmm. Really reevaluating what you have in place right now from both a BC and, mm-hmm. you know, even, you know, that crisis management kind of communication piece, just being able to know what's going on. What is the business feeling? What are your employees feeling? Mm-hmm. Your expats, you know, all those pieces, and understanding kind of where you're at right now so that you can start reevaluating what might we need to shift? What do we need to update? You know, are there contact lists? I mean, as granular as that, do we need to shift our processes just enough that we can respond appropriately to help, you know, then shifting into that protection and that security for employees and expats and things like that, yeah, facilities.
Yeah, that proactive approach to how do we prepare for if this happens, if it doesn't happen, and all the time in between. I think, like, you kind of nailed on it with communicating. This is everywhere, at least in the United States right now, all over the news. So how are we communicating to our employees here in the United States and our expats that are working in countries throughout the world? What does that look like?
Well, I think it gets back to the kind of mantra that we've used with some of our clients, and I certainly like. I probably say it way too much, but it's the over-respond, don't overreact. So this isn't an overreaction point, because Hong Kong will likely continue to operate as Hong Kong for quite a while.
It's going to be a while, I think.
But it's worth taking this as an opportunity to say, you know what? What are our business processes? What are our continuity plans? What are our security policies for Hong Kong, or even internationally, just looking at it from a broad scale of if this were to happen somewhere else, have we updated those in the last 6 months or a year?
Yeah, well, and in response to some of the protests, we've certainly seen protests around the world that had a serious effect on how our businesses are able to operate, so what that looks like. So I think it's a good time, like you said, to really evaluate the things like what are your protest protocols look like? What are you telling your employees to do if this happens, not just in China, but anywhere?
Because you can't assume it's going to be as peaceful as it has been. You know, you never know. It only takes, when we saw that play out, you know, Arab Spring, it only takes little moments,
right.
You know, the shop cart vendor to get killed, whether purposefully or accidentally, you know, those little moments for this to kind of go boom. And Hong Kong's not very big.
Right.
Well, and what happens, I mean, if your back is up against the wall, right. Which I think a lot of folks in Hong Kong might be thinking that that's what this is really going to be like, what's there to lose in escalating the conflict? And so what does that mean for businesses that are there? I mean, in terms of, we've talked about security posture a little bit, and we've talked about the continuity planning of what if you can't use your main facility? What if you can't get to work because of the protests? What if your technology capabilities are severed? You lose network or internet connectivity. I think those are real risks that companies in Hong Kong should be thinking about. And then on top of that, I would throw just the, we've talked about expats, but I think just business travel. Folks go to Hong Kong for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. Hong Kong is a intersection point for a lot of folks going to other places nearby on short haul flights, because it's easy to get in and out of the new airport. I say new, it's been there almost 25 years, but to the airport to get to China and elsewhere for your travel. So we get a lot of folks transiting the airport. And although the airport's not downtown, I mean, who knows where some of the risk goes with all this. So I think those are all challenges to the company should be thinking about.
Right.
And then where do you go to get info? I think we talked about this on our Facebook Live a week and a half ago when we talked about, or last week rather, we talked about Iran. But where do you go to get information so that you understand what's really happening? The good news about Hong Kong, I think there's good mainstream media reporting, right? We've used a Wall Street Journal article and a New York Times article for this particular podcast episode in terms of prep, but Bray, where else could folks go to learn more?
Yeah, I think for Hong Kong, to your point, they enjoy some freedoms of the press that press in China don't necessarily have. So there's a lot of visibility there that, you know, you can't find with other conflicts that Hong Kong, and because of its stature and its history, there's a lot of connection there back to United Kingdom media, U.S. media, other international news outlets. I think the other places, you know, we certainly, you know, have used a lot of different vendors and things like that in the past. ISOS and their partnership with Control Risk. A lot of companies use them for different travel and security and things like that. They're going to have a bead on stuff. So there's a lot of different vendors out there that will give you some of that. You're going to pay for the customization for some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of open source. I think the other piece too, the advantage of Hong Kong is to be able to talk to your employees and your expats and your offices in Hong Kong and have those conversations with them. What are they hearing? What's being talked about there? What are they seeing on the ground? Because that's going to be more valuable to you as a business than, you know, potentially what a vendor or the news is going to say, because they're able to spell out, hey, this is impacting the street that our stuff goes down, or this is the main route that everybody takes to get to the office, and the protesters are camped out on it right now. And that arms you with some better decision-making. So I think it's not only looking at outside sources, but really having those internal conversations mm-hmm. and using your folks on the ground.
That, and I think developing partnerships with other companies in the area, I think once things really start happening, if they do, that's not the time to be figuring this out. Developing those partnerships now is really important. You know, Joe up the street's going to know something that you don't know, and continuing having those conversations.
They're the best sources of information from my perspective. And even if you're competitors, I think you're not talking about competitive information. Right. You're talking about protecting your people and protecting your assets. And I think you're going to find that most companies are open to sharing information about what they know in exchange for what you know about what's happening on the ground.
Particularly around safety, security.
Yeah. Well, we saw that with, I know we keep referencing Arab Spring, and I don't think we're calling this the next Arab Spring, but the size of those protests and then kind of the complexities of those protests, and Hong Kong could very well get there if it continues. We saw that with trying to get folks out and joining, mm-hmm. you know, with other companies to say, hey, we got a flight out, you know, we got room, get your folks there.
Bill me.
Well, I think you keep hitting on it, because that's a situation when I think all three of us were mm-hmm. working in the same organization at the time dealing with that specific situation. So that was scary for everyone involved. And like you said, it's not that yet, but doesn't mean that that couldn't become that.
I think this protest is at least the big one, the big two over the weekend, a few weeks back when the bill got pulled, and then they protested the next day as well. The one that had 2 million, they estimated it like 2 million folks. I think that's much larger than anything we saw during Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the strongest days of protest at Trahir Square in Cairo, I think that was a few hundred thousand people, if that. I guess I don't remember. It's 2011, right?
Yeah.
2012.
But you remember we had to make some very, very quick decisions, and we had to hold our executives to the point where we needed them to help us make those decisions so that we could execute.
Yeah, I think the characteristics of the Arab Spring protest necessitated quick, decisive action on some things. And we had to make some fast choices, and we had to take some, mm-hmm. what could be considered some extreme steps to protect the offices and the employees and things like that. I think with Hong Kong, we have the benefit of a little bit of the size and scale of it is, as has been described, unlike the, you know, protest size we've seen in the past. So there's certainly complexities there. I think the advantage is nobody's trying to topple anything yet.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, so that there is it's a maintaining of the status quo or maintaining of their sense of independence. And so they have something to be gained by not taking extreme steps in terms of kind of burning the place down.
Right. And I think from a business perspective, we had a lot of lessons learned out of previous incidents. So we can take those lessons and really, We have time here to talk through plans, to develop radar screens so that we can monitor the situation.
And see what's coming.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think this is a little different from Arab Spring in terms of, you know, kind of Bray's point. I don't think the end game here is going to look like it did in Morocco and right. Egypt and Bahrain and some of the places we were dealing with back during Arab Spring.
I hope not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's going to be it's going to get so violent that you got to get everybody out of there. I mean, that would just be, it would just be like civil war Hong Kong for you to get to that. Compared to what I think we're going to see is just peaceful democratic protests. It's just going to be disruptive. And we don't know the end game of what this means. Does it topple the chief executive in Hong Kong? You know, does she resign over time? This was her bill. Does the head of the Security Bureau leave? He's the one that wrote the bill and brought the bill to the council. But I don't think we're going to see the collapse of government like we did in Egypt, for example, where, you know, the whole thing went down with Mubarak and the military engaged in a coup in order to take control. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're going to see that in Hong Kong. Because, you know, I mean, one of the biggest lessons learned for me out of Arab Spring was just how fast it moved Cairo, or Egypt, I should say, to where, like, the U.S. embassy staff couldn't even get back to the embassy, right? They were managing their own crisis situation from a security perspective from their condos a few miles from the embassy. I mean, it was thereafter action from the State Department on this was just nuts. But they, like, nobody saw it moving that fast. And we encountered the same thing as we were dealing with our former employer and the things we needed to do there.
I think that one big lesson learned, I think, that I kind of took away from that experience too, was that because it happened so quickly, I think we couldn't expect help from the United States government in those situations. We had to act much quicker. And again, I don't think that the protests are going to be as violent here, and I don't think that the end game is going to be the same. But some similarities as far as the disruption could be that we can no longer have offices in a certain area of the city or things like that, and we can't mm-hmm. expect help from external sources where we may have to do it ourselves. So what does that look like if it were to come to that?
Well, I think even to kind of hopefully touch one last time on kind of the differences here is that, you know, even law enforcement here and those partnerships that companies and businesses kind of appreciate, I think, in Hong Kong with police and law enforcement, they're not defending an individual as we were seeing in Arab Spring and we often see in some of these other kind of unrest situations. They're really trying to control the state. It's a police action similar to what we see in the United States with protests and things like that.
They're following the rule of law.
Right. They're trying to enforce the law, and that's all.
It's a great comparison because what we saw in Cairo was that the police were defending Mubarak.
Right.
Until the coup.
Till the tide turned.
Yeah.
And I think that's Hong Kong citizens' greatest fear eventually is that that independence that the police will shift at some point.
And they've already expressed this fear because I think they were not happy with – a lot of the protesters were unhappy with the police response to the protests over the prior weekend. That they thought there were challenges in how the police responded.
Well, and they're even starting to get nervous. The citizens are of, you know, those elected officials mm-hmm. and people that are in charge of the government and how much influence and connection they have back to China. And I think that's just Hong Kong citizens are used to that degree of autonomy, and they're kind of begrudging acceptance of, you know, China's influence or connection to China, that they're really trying to hold the line. They're trying to hold the line against Chinese influence, and they're starting to see some of that deteriorate with the business community not speaking up early or the heads of state and the political officials not kind of going to bat for them, that they're really taking it upon themselves. And I think that's the long game here for them is to try to hold off China. And so that's where the uncertainty and that's where the complexity really kind of manifests. Is it going to turn tomorrow? Probably not, but eventually it's going to get there. And so I think the business community and, you know, their employees and their expats have to start thinking about what does this look like? What does this look like 10 years from now? Does this change? But what can we do today to make sure that our operations continue? But what does this look like going forward?
Mm-hmm. Let's wrap this up by just talking about some particular triggers that might happen that would cause alarm. I mean, I think one is that this bill comes back to life. Right now it's suspended. It hasn't been withdrawn. Protesters asked that it be withdrawn. That didn't happen. Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, suspended, meaning it's not going to be heard. But she can just bring it back, is my understanding, anytime she wants. And a future chief executive can do the same thing because the bill has not been withdrawn. So that's, in my mind, that's definitely a trigger that's going to mean more protests, more disruption, more unrest. What are some others that could happen?
I think one of the things kind of positive triggers perhaps is the business community becoming a little bit more overt in their disagreement with the bill and talking about it as such and being a little bit, say, courageous, but you know, more willing to speak out against it or to detail out what the implications are, more so than they've already done. And especially in the future, if they do it kind of in advance of any protests, I think their voice carries a lot of weight, as we've discussed.
I think furthermore, the citizens are really speaking up as well. So they're not going to sit back and just wait and see what happens. They're going to speak up and voice their concerns as well. And I think that's a very positive thing that's coming out of this.
I think another trigger to watch for would definitely be a negative trigger, but it would be more direct action by China to interfere in the internal operations of Hong Kong. So I think, and I actually think that's going to happen. I think that's probably the long-term plan of some of this. But I think the more that you see more direct interaction by authorities in mainland China inside of Hong Kong, the more challenging the security situation, disruption on the ground is going to be.
When I think if they end up charging any of these kind of big business players from Hong Kong in China with corruption similar to what they've been doing with Chinese business leaders, if they somehow get to the point where, you know, we're going to charge somebody in Hong Kong for this to help justify, that's going to be a little bit of a bellwether and a trigger point. I also think just watching the protests, I don't think, to your point, John, I don't think the protests are going to go away, but how the protesters are protesting, if there's a change from kind of the peaceful kind of just mass collection of folks to make their point, because that seems to be enough for them right now, is to just show up in mass. If they start changing their tactics, this could take several different routes.
So that's it for this edition of the Managing Uncertainty podcast. Join us next week for two editions, our news edition and news and current events edition at the beginning of the week, and a deep dive into an interesting topic later in the week. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Managing Uncertainty, produced by the experts at BrightPath. To receive notifications of new episodes, join our newsletter at brightpath.com or subscribe to your favorite podcast player, such as iTunes or Google Play. Learn more about the services and trusted advice from BrightPath by visiting brightpath.com. That's BrightPath.com.